Thanks for listening, and thanks, members, for supporting KBOO Portland. The time is 11:30. Coming up next, Art Focus is off today. Instead, we'll hear an interview with Amy Tan, author of The Joy Luck Club, who discusses her latest novel, The Valley of Amazement, about courtesans in China in the early 20th century with host Richard Walensky. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Mobilizing Local Culture, a University of Oregon Arts Management workshop in Portland, June 23rd through the 28th, showcasing the ways in which local culture mobilized to make a difference in neighborhoods across the city. More info at aad.uoregon.edu/summerintensive.
Welcome to Bookwaves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Amy Tan, whose latest novel is The Valley of Amazement. Amy Tan is the author of several other novels, including Joy Luck Club, Bonesetter's Daughter, Saving Fish from Drowning. Also, there's a memoir and two children's books, the libretto for an opera, and a PBS TV series based on one of those children's books. But this book, as with your other novels, deals with mother-daughter relationships and deals specifically with, I guess, the idea that your grandmother might have been a courtesan in China around 1910. You had been working on a novel basically set in a small village in China, and you were looking through photos because I guess there was going to be a sequence with courtesans, and suddenly you saw a photo of these 10 Shanghai women. You said, that could be my grandmother.
It was even more striking, actually. These women were called the 10 Beauties of Shanghai, 1911, and five of them were wearing an outfit identical to what my grandmother was wearing. And my first thought was, wow, that's a pretty popular outfit. I read more about the clothing and about courtesans and discovered that the clothing details were actually specific to courtesans, as was the setting, the Western photo studio. And that set me on a trek, obsessive trek, into learning more about courtesan culture.
And you had known there were pictures of your grandmother, but there was no idea at the time
I didn't know the significance of the clothing details or the posture or the photo studio. And I still can't say, of course, with any certitude that she really was a courtesan. Family history or lore seems to make that implausible, but other family accounts, family research that I've made also make it quite possible. So it just depends on which side of the family lore I choose to follow.
Your cousin wasn't happy with this.
No. She emphasized that the family was wealthy, so she had no reason to do that. She was quiet, she was traditional and old-fashioned, and never would have thought that. What was striking to me in her comment is that it was the same notion that many people have that is stigmatized, that women in circumstances like that, that somehow it was their own choosing, as if they had made a career choice based on insatiable sex desire. Whereas many of these women had been kidnapped or forced, sold by family members, or forced by poverty to become courtesans, and would have been lucky to be courtesans instead of ordinary streetwalkers. So it was also understanding that, you know, people would have this misperception. The part that definitely wasn't true, however, is the old-fashioned part, the quiet part. In talking to other people, family members, I discovered she was actually quite foul-tempered and had a very strong opinion about many things. Part of my discovering the significance of the photo, whether she was a courtesan or not, was this sense that she had come alive. And I thought to myself, if somebody had said about me that she was quiet and traditional and that she was a good cook and a seamstress and never did anything improper, it would be as though I had really died many different ways, that I didn't exist. And so when I discovered that my grandmother really had a much stronger personality, I felt she'd been resurrected. And that made me very happy. The other part is a mystery. The mystery includes why would she have come to be wearing those clothes. If it was done as a lark, why? If it wasn't? So it unleashed a number of things. But what I was most caught by was the possibility that she had been, and I wanted to know what that world was like, what the circumstances were, what kind of attitudes and beliefs that she would have had about the world she was in, as well as about others. How could she trust people? What did she think of herself in comparison to what people thought of her?
Amy Tan, you'd been working on a book, but suddenly you needed to follow your obsession.
Yes, which is the way I've always written. It's just that one obsession became stronger than the other. Both of them started, however, with a question about self-identity and who are we and who do we become? What are the influences that shape who we become? And that's why I'm so keen to know more about my grandmother, my ancestors.
Let's go back a little bit and pull it all together. So this earlier novel that you were working on was going to take place in a village that wound up to be the village in Valley of Amazement, a small segment of the story. But originally you went to China, and there's a photo of a place called Dimen or Dimen, which I guess inspires Heavenly Mountain and the village.
Yes, Dimen. It's a village where the Dong minority live, and they're rice farmers. That area of China is the poorest and most remote of all the provinces in China. And we went there, Stuart Wallace and I, a composer of the opera, we went there to do some research on the singing culture. But in doing so, also came to know a lot more about the life of those people there. I went back a couple of times more to do research for an article on that place for National Geographic.
That's the town that you call Moon Pond.
Moon Pond. Moon Pond is actually a couple of villages merged together. There was a village I also went to in Anhui Province, which is about 250 miles from Shanghai. A very tiny little village where many of the young people have already moved out to go to the big city to work. And there is a pond there called Moon Pond. And we got to stay, Lisa C. and I. We went together. We always wanted to travel together. And we went to this little city that had one of its homes removed and sent to the Peabody Essex Museum in Salem. And we stayed in the other one that was still there in the village, a 400-year-old mansion belonged to a merchant. Multiple rooms, obviously. He had multiple wives. And so Lisa and I got to see what it's like to live in a 400-year-old house and pretend to be one of two of the wives. And it was miserable. It was cold. It was so cold. And I slipped a number of times in the mossy corridors there. And she was so right. I wanted to stay there for 2 weeks before I went there, thinking I could write in the wonderful romantic environment of a little village and little geese cackling outside. And now Lisa said we should stay there a maximum of 4 days.
Sounds like Violet's fantasies of what it would be like
exactly,
were yours.
Exactly. I put that down. She's thinking she's going to be the scholar's wife, you know, in a garden of repose and meditating on immortality or something. Yeah. The only immortality is that you would die and remember forever how miserable you were.
You're listening to an interview with Amy Tan, whose latest novel is The Valley of Amazement. I'm Richard Walensky on Book Waves.
Yes, and I'm Brian. I'm joined here with Sam, and we are on KBOO Radio. We are in our spring membership drive for 2014, Sam. It's been 46 years that KBOO's been on the air, and we're on the air with the support of our listeners. That's the main way that we keep this signal going out across the airwaves and over the internet all these years. 877-500-5266 is the way to contribute to this radio station right here during our spring membership drive on the web, www.kboo.fm.
That's KBOO.fm. And whatever area code you're in, it's 877-500-5266. That is the number that was employed by Mary, who renewed her membership right here in Portland. And Judy became a new member.
Yay!
From Vancouver. Welcome, Judy, to the KBOO family. And welcome back, Rick from Aloha. And one more for Mary. These are folks who have tasted the fruits of KBOO membership and found them sweet, as I'm sure Judy will over the coming year. And I'm looking forward to hearing back from Judy to renew her membership next year. Thank you, everyone, and welcome. And I want to thank and welcome you, dear listener, but I cannot unless and until you make that call. 877-500-5266. KBOO is one of several services of which you avail yourself day in, day out, week in, week out, every month, and it's the only one in which you get to decide whether or not you'll pay, how you'll pay, and when you'll pay. Of course, when is right now, and how is up to you, and what amount is up to you. So call 877-500-5266. We have some of your friends and neighbors who have gotten involved in a way that made sense and at the level that for them. That's New Cascadia Traditional at 1700 Southeast 6th Avenue and Bombay Chat House at 804 Southwest Yamhill. These are restaurants in Portland who got involved by agreeing to feed our volunteers, ready to take your call at 877-500-5266. And my friends Jeremy and Carola and Mark, they want to know what level makes of financial involvement makes sense for you. So call them up right now and tell them. 877-500-5266. For our listeners who wish to avoid chatting with other people, use the website kboo.fm. Whatever reason that's more convenient for you, go ahead and do that. Or come see us in person. It's a rare, beautiful day for this time of year. Take advantage. Have a little bike ride down Southeast Ankeny Bike Boulevard. And when you get to 8th Avenue, turn north and find us right there. 20 Southeast 8th between Southeast Ankeny and East Burnside. Come and see us in person. My friend Will is right there at the reception desk. He will greet you and he'll offer you coffee and tea. And you can walk all the way back to the Studio One we are using as our little base of operations here. Come and make your cash or check or credit card donation right here in person. See the faces behind the voices. And I guarantee you, folks, we have the faces for radio. So come and say hello. 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. Introduce yourself over the phone at
877-500-5266 or on the web at kboo.fm.
Amy Tan, you began writing that novel and there was going to be a sequence involving a courtesan, which is how you began.
In a way, I went to the Asian Art Museum in San Francisco. It was an exhibit on Shanghai, and at one point I saw an illustration of a courtesan, a bunch of courtesans, and the docent said that courtesans actually had been quite instrumental in bringing Western culture into popularity in Shanghai. Furniture, food, clothing, that they also had the greatest independence of all the women of any class during that time. They could move about freely, make their own decisions. It was a very limited amount of freedom once they were not courtesans. They descended into a life that was quite different. But to me, the idea of independent women who had influence on culture, on history in a way, fascinated me. And so I thought of including a courtesan, possibly, as a side character, somebody who this main narrator would run into, not knowing that I would suddenly take the book apart and make the courtesan the lead character.
You did something else, which is you made the choice to make this character, Violet, to give her an American mother who is kind of the madam of this courtesan place,
yeah.
A hotel, whatever
house,
it is.
House, a social club.
Hidden Jade Path. In so doing, you bring in the American element, viewing Shanghai and courtesans almost from an American point
right,
of view.
Right, right. Well, I did it for a number of reasons. One is this question of identity that, you know, oftentimes we come from a place and we're very secure and sure of ourselves, assured of our place in society, and suddenly we land in a different country, in a different world, and all of our privileges and assumptions don't work anymore. And that's what happens to this woman, Lucretia, she has many different names. And then her daughter, who also feels she has the privileges of an American. I'm fascinated with the idea of people having to change their self-identity as a result of how they are perceived, their new identity in the country. The other is I'm an American, and I have that point of view, and when I go to China, I take that with me. And I wanted to view that world as I did as an American looking into history at that time and what was happening and feeling the significance from that point of view of an outsider and having that view become much more intimately that of the view I have to live with. So it's necessarily those two viewpoints.
You've chosen to translate the names. The idea, it's a convention from a book called Sing Song Girls of Shanghai, which is to use these adjective names like loyalty, perpetual, rather than the Chinese name.
Right. It would have been very difficult for readers to remember the names. My Chinese name, for example, is Tan Anmei. You could have Tan Anmei, Tan Yuhan, Li Bingzi, all those. And it'd be very hard to keep them straight. Whereas if you just use the names, the portion of the names that are meaningful, then you would be able to understand them, remember them a little bit better. My name, then, is Blessing from America. If I were to translate that and just use my name as a character, it'd probably just be Blessing or Foreign Blessing or something like that. So I used the names. Now, the convention that I used was one chosen by a very well-respected author, Eileen Chang, or Chen Eiling. She was the author of Lust Caution, which is, later was made into a movie more recently. Many acclaimed novels, and she was a translator. She had spoke perfect English. The novel is a classic written in Shanghainese. Sing Song Girls is a terrible word because it comes with it that 60s stereotype of some exotica viewed from an imperialist point of view. But they were the courtesans, basically, the flowers of Shanghai. It was a novel based on his experiences, his nightly forays into the courtesan houses of Shanghai in 1893.
Amy Tan, the courtesans themselves, a courtesan is not a prostitute. And I keep thinking, is there a similarity between the courtesan of China and, say, the geisha of Japan?
It would be closer to that than, say, just a courtesan in San Francisco, turn of the century, in a whorehouse. But they were part of the sex trade. You know, if you consider the sex trade anything that involves commerce and sex. So they were courted by men, and they might have had, say, 4, 5, 6 suitors who brought them gifts. These men would be there with their friends. It was more like the Playboy Club. But they were also wooing a particular woman. And the courtesan would be the one who would choose later on which of these men would be granted favors. They would also be working, the courtesans, for a contract with a patron. And that meant a monthly stipend for fidelity for however that period was contracted for. So it was quite different. But they were unlike geishas because geishas, I think, followed a convention of clothing that did not deviate. You know, they had certain clothing that they always wore, always did their hair in a certain way. Courtesans in China were known for innovation. They were constantly changing their clothes and their hairstyles, looking more Western, and sometimes taking on the clothing of men.
You're listening to an interview with Amy Tan, whose latest novel is The Valley of Amazement. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves. Of course, these courtesans, they start very young because they're kidnapped or whatever, and they're virgins, and they pay extra to change that. That could be, that's quite a bidding war. But eventually they reach the age of 25 or 27, and then things get a little dicey.
I think that in reality, the courtesans were looking at the end of their careers by their earlier 20s, say the 21, 22. By then, they should have found a situation as a concubine in a rich man's house. And if they waited too long, their choices were going to be quite limited, as it is in Violet's case. Very rarely would a courtesan be able to marry as the first wife to a rich man, a well-respected man. And if they did not get a situation as a concubine, they were really looking at sinking into this continuum of the sex trade. Second-class courtesan, streetwalker, somebody worked in a flower opium house, even descending to the gutters, which is what happened to some of the most popular, famous courtesans of their time. You know, pride or whatever had them remaining independent. They wouldn't allow themselves to become concubines. And they ended up dead in the streets, addicted.
You're listening to an interview with Amy Tan, whose latest novel is The Valley of Amazement. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Community Radio's Spring Membership Drive. And I want you to pick up your phone right now and dial 877-500-5266 to become a member of KBOO. You've been hearing Richard Walensky speaking with Amy Tan about, you know, some of the more, some of the less pleasant aspects of the topics and issues covered in her novel, The Valley of Amazement. And I guess it's moving, it's kind of sad, and this is one aspect of the human condition. And that's what you get at KBOO. You get the information, you get the interviews that plug you into and can bring you news and arts and culture and perspectives that really put you in touch with the whole range of what we are about, both as people, as members of a community, of a society, and just as thinking, feeling creatures. And what's that worth to you to be put so in touch with the whole range, the entire spectrum of political perspectives, of feelings and emotions? I don't really know what kind of price to put on that. Hopefully you can think of an amount of a cash contribution that you can make, a kind of token saying, thank you for bringing this to my attention, and please continue to do so. And we can, with your support. 877-500-5266. For those of you who are listening earlier this hour to D.M.A. Roberts speaking with directors and producers from Portland Center Stage and Coho Productions, you wanted to grab some of those tickets to their upcoming productions, you can still do that. 877-500-5266. With your $60 contribution, you can pay that all at once. We will hook you up. You and a guest will get to go to Maple and Vine, which runs through May 24th, or check out the last 5 years running till June 22nd at Portland Center Stage. These are all ages shows. The tickets will be sitting here at KBOO waiting for you to pick them up during business hours. However you do it, and for whatever reason, just do it right now. You can even use our website at kboo.fm.
You know, Sam, it's very possible that people listening to us right now are listening to us over the internet, not even in the United States.
That is possible.
And we've heard from people around the world previous membership drives.
Finland, France, Russia, Pakistan.
It's an amazing resource that we have here, and we're able to bring that to you wherever you are. If you have an internet connection, you can hear us. That's fantastic. It just blows my mind. And the way that that happens, the only way that that has happened all these years now, is with the support of our members. Listeners turning the corner to Member Street.
Nice.
Yeah, and wandering down Member Street and saying, wow, KBOO sounds different on this side of the street than it did around the back corner.
It
was like, oh, I like KBOO. Once you turn and wander down Member Street on KBOO, the signal is clearer.
Mm-hmm.
You have a connection to the station that wasn't there before.
It
does happen. When I first became a member of KBOO back in 1991, I was a changed person. Seriously, this is no lie. It was a changing event for me. Let today be the day that you change from that passive listener to an active member of KBOO by calling 877 500 5266.
Yes, when you know you've done your part to make that signal happen, to make that signal available, not just to you, but to everyone around you, to your friends and neighbors and people you don't even know, maybe people you know and don't particularly care for. That's okay. Not everyone likes everything on KABU. Not everyone likes everyone else. The point is that we're all working together for something that benefits all of us. And that happens when you call 877-500-5266. How about starting off at, say, $6 a month? You can do that. I bet there's someone out there with $500 and you're thinking, I want to put this to good use. No better use than right here at KABU. Invest your disposable income, your extra cash, your pennies, nickels, and dimes, whatever amount. Invest it in your community. Invest it in an institution that makes everything better. KBOO.FM is our website. Use our safe, convenient, easy, and secure website, our web form, to make your fully tax-deductible 501c3 type charitable donation is what the IRS calls it. And I quibble with that because this is not charity. This is an investment in your community. I'm going to keep hitting that because that's really important. How important is it? What number? Kind of, how do you quantify that? Take a moment to think about it and call 877-500-5266. Perhaps you'll be lucky enough to hear Mark take your call and you can tell him the amount of your radio bill and how you wish to pay it. Use your credit card to pay it all at once or break it up into 12 monthly payments each year. The cool thing about the monthly thing, Brian?
Yes, quickly.
Is that it goes on and on. You don't have to renew it. You set it and forget it, and you are done. And
eternity.
Every time you hear it, you know you're doing your part to keep KABU going. And speaking of keeping KABU going, we're going back to the program right now, so make that call, 877-500-5266.
Amy Tan, your books tend to focus on this mother-daughter relationship, and in this case, we have three separate generations of mother-daughter. Obviously, as you go back to it, you're once again trying to find things out about yourself. From this book, what do you get out of watching Violet and Lulu, or Violet and her daughter Flora? What do you come out of it with?
I came out with a better understanding of patterns of abandonment in my family. One is the realization that my mother felt abandoned when her mother killed herself, that she had told me they had a metaphorically tie chains to her ankles so she wouldn't fly off with her mother, and said, please don't go, don't go. And she was left basically with a house full of strangers. My mother, many years later, abandoned her daughters. You know, she left three daughters behind in Shanghai when she went to the United States. And I thought to myself, how could she do this? What was in her that made her think that sometimes a mother must leave her daughters? I also found in writing this notions of independence that run through our family and traits that I have within me that obviously must have started with my grandmother or even before with her mother, my grandmother's mother, and has come down through the generations. So this quality of independence, stubbornness, or a kind of persistence, my mother emphasized with me. She would say it in such a negative way, though. I wanted to reject it. She would say, you must have a job, a really good job, so that if you ever wanted to leave your husband, if you got married, you could in an instant without even thinking how you would take care of yourself. And I thought, why would you think I would have such a terrible marriage? But what she was saying is that you must always be able to make your own decisions. She also said, you should never let other people judge you and make you feel that's who you are. And she would discount what people said, even if it was good. And I thought that also was a terrible thing to say, that you couldn't trust what people said. If you think about what happened to my grandmother, whether she was a concubine or a courtesan or what have you, you could understand, you could see how any woman in a life like that might have had to develop that attitude in order to keep herself sane, in order to keep herself whole. And that is the kind of understanding I've had by writing this book.
It seems to me, at least in terms of this book, that when you're writing, you're almost in a trance-like state, just trying to let stuff come to the surface, which means that on a second reading, when you're proofing it, do you sometimes sit back and go, I can't believe I wrote that?
I often feel that way. You know, I think the best writing I do is when I'm just submerged into the world and I'm just writing as I see it and feel it. I do have to go back and clean things up, but I think the writing is smoothest when that happens to me. And that only happens to me toward the end of the writing when I pretty much know where the story is going and who the characters are and know what they would likely say. But I also have times when I've struggled and I've written and I go back and reread it and I say, boy, did somebody who was brain damaged write this? I cannot believe these sentences. It's completely incomprehensible. That's what happens when you write at 4 a.m. with very little sleep. And a lot of that was done and I had to completely rewrite things, you know, once I saw those sentences.
But on the other hand, the content is going to be bubbling up from your unconscious, and that's the most important part about that first draft, isn't it?
It is, and it requires a lot of thinking about something so that the first drafts or the false starts are really not a waste of time. This amalgam of obsession, the questions, the ambiguity, the things that I've been thinking about, combined with research and narrative and character all come together so that when it does rise at a moment where it seems to just come out naturally, it really has been the result of, you know, years of thought and work. Sometimes I read the story and I read it then at that point like a story, not like something I'm trying to craft into a story. And I'm surprised that I can just read it that way and get lost in it the same way that I hope a reader does. I think that's what I enjoy the most is when I can forget how much I had to work on suspense and I can simply read it and it's there for me as well.
Amy Tan, have you started work on another book?
I have. I've started on a new novel called The Memory of Desire and also a nonfiction book on writing.